Hi, this is Writer's Cast. I'm your host, David Wilk. I'm here today on March the 5th in Westport, Connecticut, interviewing Tony Abbott, best known as a children's book writer who lives in Connecticut near me. And we're here to talk about his newest books, but also just about writing in general. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks.
We have a beautiful day.
It is. It's lovely outside.
Unusual, it seems, for our winter this year. So we find ourselves in Westport, Connecticut, mm-hmm. which is someplace you have a connection to.
Yeah, I worked here for many years.
Yeah, and I noticed on your website that you talked about working in bookstores. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. You know, it's funny. Only in retrospect, I suppose, that it occurred to me that just about every job I've had after college has been related to books. I went to the University of Connecticut. I graduated from there. But while I was there, and for like 2 years after I graduated, I worked at the co-op, the university bookstore.
In stores,
yeah. Yeah. And
was Susie there then? Susie Starbuck?
Oh, gosh, you know.
Do you know who she is?
You know, the name sounds really familiar.
Yeah, she's the manager of the store, and she's been there really long.
Well, the position is changing. It started out in the basement of one of the old buildings right there near the Student Union, and then it changed to another, and now it's on its third location. I have been back there. It's much more like a Barnes & Noble now.
Yes.
It's a beautiful store. Anyway, I worked there after college, and and then I worked in actually a store. I don't know. You may remember being from this area called Little Professor.
Certainly.
Yeah, I used to work at the Little Professor bookstore up in that Playhouse Square or something like that, long time ago.
Yeah.
And then I was at a couple more trade bookstores, and then I got then I went to the Fairfield University bookstore. This is sort of going full circle, university bookstore. So because my dad was a teacher, a professor at Fairfield U, and I went. I got a job there, it was an opening, and I found out about it, and I got it there. And then I got a call from somebody who was a friend of mine and said, there's an opening now at the Fairfield University Library. And so I said, the bookstore's so much fun and all that stuff, So I said, I think I'm going to stay here. And then I thought about that for 2 or 3 minutes. I said, wait a minute, that is absolutely crazy. I think a library is a step up from a bookstore like that. So I went over there and I talked to the librarian, and it was just a clerk position, really. I had no library degree, but I took that job, and I stayed there for a number of years. I met my wife there. She also worked at the library, so that was a very good thing.
So you're a book family.
So I'm a book, yeah. So it was, and then after the library, I worked. Actually, this guy had moved on from the library, and he was now working at Greenwood Press in Westport, and he said, oh, by the way, there's a small company in Westport that I hear is through a friend of mine, it's got a position open. Would you like to move on yet again? And I said, well, sure, it's all books. So I said, yeah. So I went to this publishing company. I worked there for 17 years until I sort of worked myself into a position where I would have to quit in order to write books or turn down a book contract. And I said, well, this is a sign. I'm not going to turn down a book contract. So I went down to part-time, and then, even further than that, finally I quit that job and became a full-time writer.
Full-time writer is a tough thing to be.
It is a tough thing, and it was, and I had a family by this point. I had...
I was going to ask you about that. You have two kids?
Yeah, I have two
kids.
And
how old were they when you quit your job?
Well, my youngest was 6, my oldest was 10. And, my wife said, she was really, and they were behind me. They said, let's do this. I sort of choreographed this situation where I had two book contracts staring me in the face. And so I could take one and still work on the side and weekends like I had been doing at the working full time. Or I could, do something about that full time job and take the two book contracts. So I did. And these are both series contracts, so they're more like having a full time job. You write a book every 2 or 3 months and you get a check every time you
finish.
So
this was the first book you worked on was a series, actually.
Yeah, the first books I worked on were a series. I was still working at that time, but I then went down to part time.
Was the first The Droon?
No. This was a series called Danger Guys, which is I like to think of as a cult classic. Probably only because it's very rare and hard to get a hold of.
Now, so it's out of print.
It's out of print. Yeah, you can find copies here and there, and some libraries have it. Some public libraries and school libraries have them. And I'm always surprised when somebody holds one up in an audience. And I say, "Oh my gosh, you go back, don't you?" So.
And what was Danger Guys about?
Danger Guys was about these two kids, and you know, it's funny if you want to talk about how I got started as a writer. I took lots and lots of classes for adults writing for children, and you know, I'd first gotten into it because I was reading to my daughter, my first daughter. She's now 23, but when she was young, I was reading to her, and I got to read all these books that I never read when I was growing up, because the, you know, the children's book publishing industry just wasn't that elaborate and developed as it was by the time, you know, 20 years ago. When I was reading these books with my daughter, I said, "Oh, these are fun," you know, books by William Steig and William Joyce and people like that that I had never. So I said, "You know, this is fun. I think I'm going to try this," and so I tried and failed, you know, for the first 20 times that I tried to write something. But when she was in first grade, she started to read these easy readers, and I said, "Oh, you know, I love this form. It's some of the chapter books are like 60, 80 pages." 8 or 10 chapters. They're like short novels, you know. They're not very sophisticated, but the humor is kind of funny, and you can have a story that develops, maybe 2 or 3 strands of a story. And I said, this is the kind of thing that I like. So I thought about what kind of story I would write for this, and I'd always loved adventure stories, movies and television shows and books and short stories and everything when I was growing up. So I said, oh, you know, I think it's going to be an adventure story. I think that's the thing that's going to occur to me. One of the things that I did was to read everything I could get my hands on that was being published in the age group that I'm thinking of, like first, second, third grade level. So I read everything, and there was really no adventure. The kind of adventure you would find would be like mystery stories, but it would be a lot of them were like the missing cat, or you know, the
kind of simplistic,
very simplistic, yeah. And I don't want to say this the wrong way, but very sort of girly oriented. There weren't really hard boy adventures. So I saw a gap there. I thought this is a place where I can, you know, that I can do my thing. So I was thinking, you know, love those old serials when I was growing up. And of course the Indiana Jones films were under my belt because they were a, you know, sort of a spoof and a takeoff and an homage to those serials. I said, well, okay, I want to do something big. You know, they're not in the neighborhood anymore, and it's not, you know, like the mystery of the lost newspaper and things like that. This is right. Going to be a big life and death thing. So I get these two characters, and they come to me one day, and they come to me, you know, voices with talking, and they're having fun. It's like they pop into my head, and I say, oh, these guys are great. They're going to take me on this adventure. So I wrote this story. It's called Danger Guys, and it involves these two kids. One is very booky. He's read everything. He knows all the plots, you know. So whenever they get into an adventure, he'd say, "Oh yeah, you know what they did once in a Zorro movie, you know."
Right.
And the other kid is the other best friend. He's so great at sports. I mean, he's, you know, it's almost simplistic, you know, the mind and the body
right.
split. But the two of them together make this great action team. And they, so the first adventure, they go through this thing and they get the bad guys are looting this. Ancient temple, and they get them arrested, and they become heroes, and they're known from that day forward as Danger Guys. So that was the launching book, and so I wrote that, and I sent it into a publisher, and the publisher, after a couple tries, publisher called back and said, "Oh, you know, we love this, and we want to make it the cornerstone of a series." And you know, of course, yes, that's what I wanted. And meanwhile, while I was writing this first book, I said, "Oh, you know what? They're in this lost temple thing, but what if they have some other kind of adventure?" And I was writing the notes for that. So when the call came and I went down to New York and we were talking, the vice president and the editor and I at this table, and we're saying, you know, and they're saying, "We'd like, you know, to think of this as a series." And in the back of my mind, I said, "Yes, of course," because I've, you know, sort of put the message in there. Am I talking too long here on this
no,
one
this
thing?
No, this is good. This is great.
So when they said a series, I said, "Well, by the way, you know, I happen to have these 3 or 4 other ideas." And they said, "Fine, 4 books." And so I went back, and they said, "You know, and can you have the second book in about 4 weeks?" So,
right.
So as you know, in this business or in any business, you just say yes to everything. I said, "Oh yeah, absolutely, oh yeah." You know, so I went back home and I told my wife, "I have, you know, I'm gonna have to close the door. I can't really talk to my children anymore because I have 4 weeks to write this
book.
I
have a 4-book contract, but
that's right. There's good news and there's bad news,
right?
And you know, don't you know?" And I was still working full time at that point, and so I You know, just every single hour up till 2 and 3 in the morning on weekends, in church, you know, writing there. And so I got it done. And so I learned very early that to be a series writer, the ability to satisfy that schedule and get those things in by deadline was, you know, puts you ahead of, you know, 9 out of 10 people that.
And when you do these, I mean, this is sort of a mechanical question, but do you write and then figure somebody's going to edit you afterwards, or do you write and edit as you go? And kind of, you know, some writers, you close that door, I'm going to get the 500 words out today and work them over and over and over until they're perfect. Other people write it all down just to get it out and then go back.
Yeah, it's sort of a combination with me. I start, you know, I've learned to start mainly because the publishers of series books need to have an outline, and they need to have a basic idea of what the story is going to be even before the actual words are on paper. So they want 2 or 3 or 4 pages of, you know, okay, this is in chapter 1, this is in chapter 2, which is, you know, a difficult thing to get into because it forces you to see the whole story from beginning to end. And things can change when you write it, but you basically have to know what the story is. Part of the reason is the publisher needs to know what the cover is going to be because they have so much lead time that they have to give the artist. And you think, oh, well, this is the tail wagging the dog, but still, you know, that's, you're talking about the package of the book, and it has to have the right sort of thing. So the outline has become very important for these kinds of stories for the series. So I write the outline, and then the editor comments on the outline. They say, okay, you know, maybe this between chapters 5 and 6 seems a little slow. There's, you know, maybe think of another action element, or there's too much action in this part. Can we stretch it out a little bit? Maybe a soft moment should happen here, where the characters realize something, and you say, oh, okay, I'm beginning to learn. You know, and all this time also, you're reading everything else that is being published in this age range so that you know what the competition is, not to steal anything, but to say, oh, you know, I can do that better. Or you know, just to find out what the competition is. And I knew at that point that I was doing something that was, with these Danger Guys books, I was doing something that was different. It was a higher profile adventure. I mean, there was life and death. There was a lot of comedy too, but, you know, basically, you know, bad adult guys stealing things is different than, you know, the lost pencil and stuff like that.
And the age group for Danger Guy is,
it was squarely second grade. It was, you know, like 7 and up.
And definitely for
boys, although
obviously girls can read it too.
Yeah, girls will read, you know, boy things, but boys will never be girl. I mean, that sort of a thing. It may have changed over the years, but basically that's it. So I start with the outline, and then I begin to write, and I go back from the outline to paper, and I always start, you know, a hard copy, pencil or pen on paper, and I begin to see the scenes, and I say, you know, well, I'm not the sort of person like, for instance, John Steinbeck, who started with, you know, like page 1, first sentence, first word of the sentence, and then wrote, and, you know, he would get couple chapters and ship it off to his publisher. Dickens was the same way, of course, because he had those deadlines, those serial deadlines, and he had to write, you know, 2 or 3 chapters every month.
To end.
And that was out of, and it was printed before he actually got to the second chapter.
So no revising.
No revising. Steinbeck was another one. If you see the manuscript, for instance, of Grapes of Wrath, I mean, the page, and he wrote on these big ledger books, it's all, you know, it's all handwritten. And there are just very few changes. And, you know, and so, but I'm not like that at all. I would look at the outline and say, you know what, there's this scene with the truck, you know, barreling down the hillside, and it's very dangerous. That's the scene I want to write now. And I know what comes before it, and I know what comes after it, but this is the one that I'm visualizing fully in my head. And I smell it, I hear the sounds, I know the emotions, and I can put that on the page today. Tomorrow, maybe I couldn't. Yesterday, I couldn't. But today, that's... So gradually, I will sort of build up parts of the story non-sequentially. And I know it's kind of a backwards way of doing things, but it works for me. And at a certain point, then it grows organically together. You know,
and then you have to stitch together the pieces.
I hate almost to say stitch. I mean, it is really a living thing growing together. And you see, you know, chapter 2 leading into chapter 3, and it becomes much more. So you can't see the seams anymore.
Well, that's actually a great lead-in for me to ask you questions about the postcard.
Yeah.
Because this is a book that came out last year as a hardcover, mm-hmm. which is somewhat unusual for kids' books. Now, I read this book as and it's, you've described it on your website, which, by the way, I want to compliment you on, a tremendous website, and for anybody who's listening to this, a great author website compared to most, and or just on its own, a great website. But the postcard is a complicated mystery to me, and you know, and I think it's something you can talk about. Putting this story together obviously was very time consuming.
Yeah, it took, and while I was writing it, I was continuing to write some of my later series, so I worked on it for 2 or 3 months, and then I had to set it aside and pick it up again.
So did you, when you started the postcard, did you have fully formed an idea?
No, let me tell you how this started. Yeah. I had written an earlier novel, which was bought by Little Brown as a part of a two-book contract, so I had the finished first novel, and there were... my editor and I revised that a little bit, but at our first meeting, face-to-face meeting, she said, well, you know, this is a two-book contract. Do you have any idea whatsoever? And it's not due or anything like that for the next year or two. Do you have any idea what the second book might be? And I guess I've learned, you know, while I was writing that first book and I was writing down ideas for the second and third book, I always have ideas. And I've got, you know, it's like Joyce Carol Oates.
Fill a notebook full of ideas.
Yes, fill a notebook. I've got lists and lists and lists of novels, some short, some very, very long, that I, you know, I'm going to have to live 200 or 300 years to be able to write. But so I said yes. And one of the things that was appealing to me for a second novel was the idea of a thriller. You know, something, I wasn't really thinking of mystery then, but I said, you know, sort of an action, but it's got a dark thing to it. And she said, that intrigued her. She said, well, why don't you work something up? And I had this idea, and it was based on this idea of a noir story, these old detective magazines. Something about them intrigued me. I had picked up this magazine from 1941 called...
Not Black Cat, was it?
No, it wasn't Black Cat. It was called, I think it was called Weird Mysteries.
I remember. Yeah, when I was, I think in the 50s,
yeah,
those magazines still existed.
They were great. They started in the 30s and probably even in the 20s with the Dashiell Hammett.
Right, with these great covers.
Oh, the cover art is incredible. Tremendous. I mean, there have been lots of books just reproducing the cover art because it's so great. Well, right. this one, I love this this magazine that I picked up, and had all these pulpy stories, and the pages were practically disintegrating. I mean, you know, those old wood pulp pages, they smell... There's such an aroma of the past in those things. Well, I love this. And I said, you know what? I want to do something with this. And I worked it over and worked it over, and I said, oh, you know what? I'm thinking of the main character somehow being a kid who is related to one of these artists who did these really bizarre, fanciful pulp covers. And I said, well, you know, this is the wrong thing. I'm a writer. It should be a writer of these kinds of stories. And I said, and then the sort of eureka moment where I said, well, in order for me to do this properly, I have to write the story, this old 1940s detective story. And when I discovered that, and I realized that that's what I was going to have to do,
it's a
story within a story. Right. This mystery grew to huge proportions.
So you know what I'd like to do
is
we'll take a little pause,
okay,
and we'll start another segment because we have much more to talk about.
Sure.
So we'll go on to part two, and this will be, you know, we'll start with the postcard and how you continue, you know, how that evolved, because I think it's really important.
Sounds great.
So thank you. This is the end of the first interview with Writer's Cast of Tony Abbott.